Okay. Especially thanks to my family for being here, and actually to my wife for diligently working on the slides to make it look good. Matthias did a great job actually introducing the context of the what we're talking about. So what I'm going to try to do in this talk essentially is to give an idea of what systems engineering is, because whenever people meet me, they ask me, you know, what exactly do you do? You know, what's really system engineering? And what's really the essence of what you're doing? Is it a science? Is it really engineering? What are the differences? So I try to actually spend some time giving you an idea of what systems engineering is. And already there was a lot of talk about living systems and the notion of dynamics and so on, so I can skip some of the slides that I have in the early sections. So I'm going to spend about maybe 15 minutes on this. Then I'm going to talk about, you know, what have we learned from actually building machines. So the main part of this talk essentially is about actually building machines, deploying them in the real world, understanding what essentially happens in the real world, and then gain insights into what the net architecture and what are the right kinds of architectures, what are the trade-offs, how do we actually design better systems at the right kind of cost, efficiency, and so on. So in that sense, it's very complementary to the scientific work that goes on in trying to understand the brain from fundamental principles, and then try to build models of the brain, and then try to come up with actually insights on how to build machines. So where they end, we take insights, and then we then try to go in engineering mode to see how to build these machines and validate them in a large scale. So the second part of the talk is really about how to think about vision, and how to think about vision as Bayesian inference. I'll explain to you what that means. And then I'll try to highlight that, you know, most of the work that's been going on actually fits a single architecture, and it also has relationships to the brain in terms of two system models and how the brain works. And the last part, if I had time, I'll try to go back and think about how to model the space of possible scenarios in terms of grammars, and then how to actually use those grammars effectively to describe the image that you see or the video that you see in terms of strings or in terms of parses of actually what you see. And the last part would be really what Matthias put in as a slide, is essentially is how all these different people in the Bernstein Focus come together to form essentially a community which is looking at the common set of problems and to learn from each other and therefore get better insights into how to build automated systems. And in fact, what we are working on is trying to bridge the gap between neuroscience, psychology, artificial intelligence, robotics, and system engineering. So let me just start with systems engineering. So if you go talk to the, there's a whole community of systems engineers, and if you go talk to them, what essentially do you do? They will say, oh, a system essentially is nothing but an integrated set of elements that accomplish a particular objective. And it can include hardware, software, firmware. It can include processes. It can include people who make these things. It can actually include information, techniques, all sorts of stuff. So it's kind of like a mumbo jumbo. It looks like everything put together. And why? Because when you build something like a space shuttle, or when you build something like a big airplane, you need essentially thousands of people working together in a systematic way and actually have an organization that can coordinate between these things and have detailed plans as to what you're building and to make sure that you can actually validate what you're building upfront before you go spend the millions and billions of dollars sending the mission to Mars. So that's really the essence of system engineering. So in that sense, the people who do systems engineering, they are essentially people like the DLR, okay, or essentially NASA, who actually have to deal with building complex machines and being able to deploy them with essentially certainty and guarantees. Now, what is systems engineering? So systems engineering effectively is, because when you build these complex systems, you have to work with people of a variety of backgrounds. It has to be engineers, scientists, essentially management people, all kinds of people who have to make the task of actually delivering the project and delivering it in time with essentially certain performance. So therefore, system engineering really is an interdisciplinary approach and a means to enable realization of successful systems. And another way to look at it is, it's the guide, it's basically a guiding process to engineer these complex systems. And what essentially is the origin of system engineering? So the origins of system engineering goes back to the 1940s and 1950s, where you essentially had, they were building actually intercontinental ballistic missiles for essentially beating the Soviet Union. Therefore, they had to actually think about a structure by which they can bring all these scientists from Caltech and a few other places and then make them work together and make essentially a system. And the way they did it essentially is they formed an organization that essentially would effectively manage the whole set of scientists, bring them together, and to figure out how to systematically build complex machines. And so it has its roots in cybernetics, general system theory. It looks at the big picture, the whole picture. It actually has to understand different relationships between different subsystems. And it has to understand what kind of emergence properties may actually arise as a result of system interactions. That's very similar to what already Matthias talked about when he talked about dynamics. And if you look at the principles that people have to focus, they have to focus on the whole. They have to think about the beginning of the project, the construction of the machine, and then after that, in operation, what happens, and then when it finishes, what happens? How do you retire it? And then you have to understand that it has very specific scoping of what you build. It has to have very specific interfaces and hierarchies. And it essentially, the system actually form depends actually on the function, and it depends actually on the purpose that you actually build the system for. And you, of course, in practice, you never have all the money you need, all the resources you need, and so on. So you need to think about trade-offs. You need to think about how to build something close enough to what you want and approximations. And you have a whole range of risks that have to be managed. And if you follow a rigorous process and a systematic approach, you have a chance of success that's going to be better. So that's the main essence of system engineering. So what does a system engineer look like? A system engineer actually has to ideally be an architect, ideally be a developer, and ideally be an operator. So in other words, the person has to think about what the use is. The person has to think about how to develop it, what essentially is the process. And the person has to think about how do you architect, what are the trade-offs in architecture, how do you design it. So ideally, a systems engineer would be somebody who is broad. But the way system engineering programs work is normally you try to get depth in one area, and then you spend your time understanding the breadth. And then you can see how to then effectively work in a team. So system engineers are actually collaborators. Collaboration's in their blood. And if you look at the system engineering field, and this is actually from NASA, so what kind of things that the system engineer has to do? Think of the system engineer like a conductor in an orchestra, actually being able to conduct the orchestra, being able to interpret the piece that is being conducted, being able to have the fidelity with which the composer actually effectively intended the conducting to be done, and then look at the people and their understanding of what their piece is and their limitations, and then manage it such that the overall integrated performance is actually an orchestral performance, that you can say, ah, this is actually, wow, that was a great orchestra that I went to. So that's really what system engineer is supposed to do. And there's a whole range of characteristics that you need to have. Now, how was I introduced to system engineering? So when I went from India to Virginia Tech to got my master's. Then I went from there to University of Washington, Seattle. And my advisor, Professor Haralik, was trying to actually build a company in the late 80s, and he failed. Because whatever he did in the lab, when he tried to put it out into the open, into the installation in the factory, it turned out that these systems wouldn't work. So what he needed was, he wanted to formalize the process by which he could actually systematically design something in the lab that would definitely work. And therefore, the need for systematization, need for thinking ahead of what you're designing and all the trade-offs was essentially important for him. So he asked me to essentially work on this topic, and I was fortunate to be given the opportunity to start working on this topic. And the way you think about essentially the process is, you normally start with something called requirements. So essentially you say, what is it that I'm building? What does the user want? So in that sense, for a vision system, it's like, in what context does the vision system have to work? And what kind of other constraints do you put in on hardware, software, and so on? And then the priors, what can I assume to be given? In that sense, what can I assume as regularity in the world? And these together goes through a process that gives you essentially the answer, which is a design. And then you have to try out many different designs and analyze them. So it means that you need to have a formal way to analyze essentially the model, based on models, the design that you came up with, and then quantify what the performance is. Normally what happens is you go through this cycle 2 to 3 times before you converge. And my dissertation work was actually focusing on how to do performance modeling. So if somebody gave me a design, how can I actually analyze the performance of that system and tell you what the limits are? It was all about basically saying, I have a probability distribution in the input. How does it propagate through the entire system? What is the output probability distribution? Can I talk about specific statistics of the output characteristics? And that's essentially what it is. And my dream was actually to build ultimately this process of actually taking the requirements and the priors and mapping it to design automatically. And this dream actually was, I would say, a virus that I caught from my advisor. So he basically had the vision that there would be a day when you could formalize, you could describe this thing in a language, you could describe this in a language and models, and then there will be an automatic procedure that compiles the system, given these requirements. That's the vision. And that vision, I think, is actually close to the Bernstein focused technology vision. And we are actually trying to figure out how to get there in step-by-step fashion. In fact, I was influenced by not only my dissertation and my advisor, but also parallel work that was going on in Stanford by Tom Pinford's group on Bayesian networks. That was the first time, actually, people thought about how to formally describe your prior assumptions in for vision, how to actually describe the likelihood model for the sensor measurements, and how to combine them together to form inference. So essentially, this is actually a seminal piece of work, which unfortunately people don't really refer to. Now, what is visual cognition? Matthias had a nice slide. I could have just borrowed it. But here is actually how you think about visual cognition or vision. You take images or video and basically translate them back into all these things. I can tell you right now there are so many chairs. Maybe not. Maybe I tell you it's 50 or 100, roughly counted. I can tell you how many people are sitting, roughly, maybe, and so on. And I can tell you that it's a sunny day outside. So essentially, it is describing what I'm seeing in terms of the physics, in terms of the world. And what you do, and you can see already, Matthias made a point that essentially the human brain, essentially, in fact, half of the human brain is dedicated for vision purpose. Therefore, in fact, what we really want is to build a brain. If you want to build a brain that's very complex, we need actually systematic engineering. That's the message. So let me take a concrete study and show you what we did at Siemens and go through the walk through the process. By the way, this is actually, if you ever drive to Switzerland and go across the border, you will be monitored by this system. And it actually will tell you, hopefully you're not in an accident, therefore it doesn't make an alert. But if you know, about 10 years ago, there was a major accident, I think it was in Switzerland or Austria, I don't remember, where essentially people died because essentially somebody went in and then they had a stopped vehicle and then essentially there was overheating in the vehicle and it suddenly went poof. And so what happened was that there were people died. So what happened was there was a need to actually try to automate and have automated software that will analyze these video clips and then essentially summarize the entire state of the tunnel, okay, for the purpose of safety. Okay, people normally, when I was in Siemens, normally asked me in the flights, you know, what do you do for a living? And then I would tell them, I actually try to take the boredom out of your life. I try to make machines that will watch boring videos and then try to summarize you only the interesting parts. So that's essentially what's going on here. Most of the time, nothing is happening. Sometimes there is actually an event which happens to be essentially an important event that has to be addressed. So for example, a person stops, you know, he's slowing down, he stops, and then maybe there's a fire and this. So by combining many sensors, for example, a smoke sensor along with vision, you could essentially already prepare essentially the emergency group. So what kind of functions did we build? So the functions that you had to deal with were smoke detection, traffic data collection, speed, number of vehicles, what kind of vehicle is going on, what is it slow, what is the traffic, is there a traffic jam, is there somebody going the wrong direction, which is a very critical part, is there somebody who dropped something, or is there a cargo that fell down, was there actually speeding and tailgating from somebody, and essentially was there a person who got down because there was an emergency. So all of these different functions you want to have the machine do. And at what performance? You want it to be at the performance of close to a human, because you want essentially the system to have no false positives. You normally have about 20 cameras per tunnel. So even if you have one alarm per day, you have 20 alarms per day per camera, then you have 20 alarms. And it, basically, the people who are looking at it will turn it off. And there are 20 functions there, so you have many alarms. So therefore, the challenge here is, how do you make the performance of this, the false positive rate, to be very low, while the detection rate, which is for the interesting part, is close to human performance? And now, let me just go straight to vision and the challenge of vision. So here, even though that looks like a very, very concrete problem, a camera looking into a tunnel, it looks like it's, you know, there should not be that much variability. But you look at this. These are actually different examples of different tunnels. In the Switzerland, actually, they tend to be good in how they actually install lights and so on, and they, you can see that the lighting is much more nicer. Whereas if you go to Austria, they basically are sloppy, and therefore you essentially have sort of, certain types of lighting which essentially is, let's say, not necessarily, I will say, really friendly to computer vision, for instance. Now let's go to the scenarios here. Here you see actually the kinds of variations that you can have. You can have, for example, there's some emergency situation there, so they have to turn the lights on. You have essentially complete blooming, okay? By the way, when you start the camera up and you start the installation, it won't be like this, because this blooming is happening because you have actually the cars going in, and then there is salt on the road, and the salt essentially is sprayed, and then the camera becomes actually now sprayed with the coating in front. Therefore, you just have scattering, which essentially becomes scatters the light. And therefore, you can't really see anything. You can't say that that's a one car or two cars, and you have significant occlusions because you can't mount the camera anywhere you want. So you have actually a lot of variability, even in this scenario. Even in this scenario, there's enough variability. There's enough non-linearities. So for example, you can have in the just outside the tunnel, you can have day and night, so therefore you can have changes. Normally the camera works when you start it up, after a while, the camera may be having fault, in which case you tend to get distorted signals. And you can have a variety of traffic densities, both oncoming, back, and so on. So why am I showing this? So from a system engineering point of view, you have to ask yourself, what is the context in which you want to design the system? And what performance you want? And what is the essentially scenario under which you want to do this? Now, this actually is the first step in system engineering. That is, what is the input space? What are the videos like? How do we formally specify that? Okay. you can use mathematical probabilistic tools to do that. And we use actually object-oriented dynamic Bayes networks. And you can think about all the variables that you have. Oh, what is the scene geometry like? What kind of materials exist? And this can actually, by the way, change because you can be the surface can be wet once or it can be dry. And then what kind of environmental conditions you have? What types of objects? What essentially is the illumination distribution? And then how can you orient the camera? All of these are essentially variables in the input. And what do I want to do with what performance, essentially? So I want to count, I want to track, I want to do all these different things. And for each of these tasks, I can tell you what kind of error metric I want, what kind of accuracy I want, how I want to have graceful degradation. I want to be able to tell that there is actually a problem with my estimate. In other words, the system has to tell, oh, look, I don't know about the scene. There's a problem. So I need to have self-diagnostics. And I need to be fast. I need to be able to use efficient algorithms. And I want to be able to also respond within timely reason. And of course, you can also have constraints on hardware, including things like humidity, temperature constraints, and so on. And you can have very specific requirements on design properties. You want modularity, you want compositionality, you want to be able to trade off computation for accuracy, you want predictability, and you want ease of extensibility. So these are things like wish lists that somebody gives you, which essentially has to be mapped to a design. So I don't expect you to see this block diagram. I'll come to that a little bit later. But effectively, this is actually the application to our patent. It was done in 2008. In fact, which already had, we had already had patents from here, 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 and then the patent application was more an integration patent. And the main message I want to tell you is what we had to do, I'll come to that, why we had to do this way. What we had to do is we had to have parallel threads, just like the brain. We had to have modular parallel threads, many channels, each doing different functions. And we had to use extensive use of context. In other words, I believe that the interpretation, visual interpretation, is actually simple because we use very heavy use of context. We have an innate understanding of regularities in the world. We essentially make those assumptions, and those assumptions then make trivialize in some sense to tell you what kind of filters and what kind of essentially Q fusion you need in terms of this. So in other words, if you do the features right, then the fusion becomes simple, okay, which is not necessarily fully understood in the community. And we also want, just like the brain, we want a deliberation mechanism. So you're not always correct, so you want to have some way of checking against rules, against facts about the world, and then verifying whether actually the estimate that you put out from essentially what I would call indexing and estimation is actually correct. And sometimes you have to go fallback and say, oh, I need to try something else. This doesn't add up. You cannot be that there is actually a change in the background when cars are continuously moving. Maybe it's snowing or something like that. So this is basically a high-level reasoning. And there's one more thing which is very important, which is the adaptive control of the parameters that essentially you have to adjust, okay? And basically, you have to self-adjust yourself such that you're optimum for this current situation. And that's basically the nature of this. Now, I'll come to this. And now, I just want to now show you some results, and then we'll go back to the architecture. You can see that actually, depending on the task, you can define appropriate performance measures, like what's the number of false positives, for example, for event alarms, what's the misdetection rate, what is the probability of incorrect tracking, accuracy and tolerance of counting, and so on. And basically, we all understand that this performance is actually a very nonlinear function of all the scene variables. And it's also a function of any tuning parameters you use, and therefore you need to have a systematic way to understand the performance. And there are two ways to do this. One is what I call white box analysis, which is a detailed theoretical modeling analysis. And the other one is basically black box, where you actually take the system, deploy it, and then in the scenarios you want, and then analyze the system. And this is actually more often done. White box evaluation is not done that often because it's more complicated to do the modeling. So here is actually an example of how you can actually synthesize from example data a variety of perturbations, and then you can actually analyze the behavior of an algorithm and produce results. So you essentially vary the scene variables, and then you push it through a generative model, which tells you what are the different examples. For example, I'll run this thing for you. So here is some example of simulated, synthesized videos that we made up, which is not fully realistic, but actually describes, for example, haze. What happens when you have camera vibrations? What happens when you have the camera nonlinearity, like gamma function change and color response change, and so on. So you can actually synthesize a lot of different perturbations from examples, and then you can actually check whether your system design is actually tolerant or not. And when you do the empirical design, testing, this is what we did in 2001. You see tons of video material of the, all the different scenarios. We actually tested first on the database of videos. We then run it on the site for 3 months and didn't watch it to really understand the essence of what really the system is doing. Especially when you're in research prototype mode, you have to do it. And then you compare the result of what the system produces against a human to get an understanding of the performance. And so we essentially did this through several iterations. It was actually a good study, case study for a system engineering project. And in fact, one of the key elements that you learn when you do such a project and you evolve the system design is that you have to be like evolution. In other words, you have to actually, you cannot afford to throw out whatever you did before. In that sense, you have to use the modules that are actually good for whatever subset of the space, and then you have to add very specific layers that are additionally providing additional performance. So in that sense, it is basically effectively evolution at work and modular sort of addition of technology. So here are actually examples of the system. So you see tracking, detection and tracking of cars, pretty boring stuff, but you see the kinds of responses the system puts out. This actually is the results from the first prototype, but the performance of the first prototype was around 90% with false positive rate of like one per or two per week, and then we had to drop it down by an order of magnitude to get the final system. So that gives you a concrete example of a complex system and how we had to go through the engineering process. Now I'm going to talk about what essentially is the design principle behind this. So what exactly is vision? How do you think about vision in a formal way? This is actually, I borrowed it from Song Chun Zhu, who is my collaborator, and who essentially is one of the leaders in essentially Bayesian inference in vision. And basically, effectively, right, what you're trying to look at is you're looking at a video signal or an image, and then you're trying to figure out what is the most probable interpretation of what's in the image or in the video. And what does that mean? Means that you need to understand what the world is, that's W, and then you need to describe what kind of prior assumptions you can make about the world. That's basically my scene prior. And then, given that the world essentially has a particular state, what is the likelihood of observing essentially a particular set of measurements? And the interpretation, which is in this case W star, essentially is the argmax of essentially the speed of W given I. In other words, looking at the posterior and trying to find the best answer interpretation. And so that's basically the way of actually the calculus for how to combine these things was, it goes back to Reverend Thomas Bayes. And that's why it's called Bayesian, Bayesian update and Bayesian inference. Now, how do you describe the world? You describe the world in terms of grammars. So here is actually another example from Song Chun Zhu and Mumford, about 2008, 2009, where you think about the original image, you think about the parts of the image, and that is basically, you can synthesize, for example, based on the estimation that you do, the actual synthesized image. So in that sense, you're trying to reconstruct what you're seeing using your model, and then seeing whether that looks close to the model, or to the image. That way you know that you've done the problem right. And here you can think of this original image as being decomposed into persons, playground, backgrounds, and then the background consists of building, chairs, and so on. And then you have further decompositions. So in this sense, what you have really is a parse of the entire scene. And it's like actually taking a sentence and then parsing the noun, verb, and so on. And how do they do it? This is very similar to how we do our real-time vision systems. It is, you have two processes, a bottom-up process, which is basically generating proposals. So you take the data, you essentially extract particular features, and then you actually are able to tell which ones are discriminated ones, which gives you proposals of, you know, what could be the hypotheses. And then using this prior distribution, you set up actually a sampling algorithm, a Markov chain Monte Carlo algorithm, which searches over possible hypotheses and then comes up with the answer. The real problem with this thing is actually the computational speed. Markov chain Monte Carlo is slow. And that's the biggest challenge. And the other problem is basically, how do you actually, what is actually PW? How do I get it? How do I get P of I given W? And how do I perform efficient inference? These are basically fundamental questions that are still being asked, and there is thousands of papers being written because of this. And most of these systems use actually expert design models for PFW. Okay. And in fact, learning the structure of PFW and the parameters is a hard problem. And people are still working on it, and this is actually in our active research area. And the likelihood model, in my opinion, should come from the physics. But it's not always possible to come up with a physical model. So I have tried to spend enough of our time to work with people who are doing physics-based vision to really come up with better physical models. And the efficient inference is possible by this idea of quick guessing followed by deliberation. That sounds like Daniel Kahneman's two-system model, where you have a quick intuitive part of the subsystem getting you partially the answer, which is based on your understanding of the regularity of the world. And then you have deliberation, which says, sometimes I'm wrong, and things are not consistent, therefore I need to change my opinion, and then I redo it. That's basically what's going on here. And you can do this optimization step by belief propagation and sampling. What's the difference between Sangchun Zhu's work and our work? The main difference is not in the philosophy, it's in how you do the modeling, because we spend more time on the physics. How do we actually design efficient hypothesis generators, which is actually propagating the Bayesian network all the way down to the lowest level and asking what filters make sense for this particular context? And then how do you actually get diagnostics? How do I know that I am good enough in this situation? And in fact, one of the things that's mostly ignored in the literature is that Bayesian guys are biased. Because if your prior is wrong, you get biased answers. So the question is, what do you do in that situation? You have to have the flexibility to change your prior on the fly, and then to be able to get robustness. And in fact, the strong Bayesians who know about this stuff, they actually spend their time understanding robustness properties of their estimators. And that's actually one of the key elements of our work. So in summary, what I have said is, vision essentially is sensed images to semantics. It's a complex system. It depends largely on how you set it up. And then you can use statistical modeling, and you can actually build a description of the world. You can actually build descriptions of how the sensed measurements are given the world. And then you can try to develop a course-defined strategy where you generate hypotheses, and then you actually verify. And if you want to build a generic vision system that works for a variety of scenarios, you need to think about grammars for composing complex Bayes networks, because Bayes networks, normally for one context, is one thing. But you need actually a flexible composition language that allows you to generate a whole range of Bayes networks. In fact, that is actually the essence of what Mann, Wally Mann, and Binford did in 1995, and not many people actually look at it. So what we learned from a lot of different work that we did, so I haven't described actually many of the work that we did in my department. I was very fortunate to work with some of the best people, very fortunate to work with some of the best academic people and to look at actually a whole spectrum of applications and to understand how this type of paradigm works. And essentially the idea is there is a central knowledge base or memory that from that memory along with goals, you can then decide what could be the kind of quick guessing or fast procedures for guessing the hypotheses and then deliberation to basically prune out errors and to get back essentially an understanding. And then this understanding may actually conflict with your knowledge, in which case you need to understand how to update, or this understanding may be incomplete, in which case you want to adjust your sensor, like turn your head or zoom in, and then you loop. So that's really sort of the cognitive architecture that that we've been using. And there's a common system design philosophy which addresses predictability, scalability, modularity, and extensibility. Now, there is a whole world out there that is not Bayesian. There is basically logic programming. There is actually AI systems that were done in the previous in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And AI initially started out saying everything is logic. And then people started working in the 70s and 80s, trying to actually extend logic to deal with uncertainty, because logic essentially is good when essentially the rules are actually true. You can actually then apply the rules and you can quickly check whether something essentially is true or not. You can prove theorems, you can do all this stuff. But when the axioms that you assumed are wrong, then your answers are wrong. So what you needed was the flexibility to add uncertainty models on top of logic. And in fact, so the Bayesian world we just saw, which essentially does graphical models and then there's many ways of doing inference, the AI world essentially was looking at extending essentially logic to uncertainties, deal with uncertainties. And we actually looked, I collaborated with the University of Maryland to essentially look at what Doug Ginsberg essentially was doing in the late 80s. And essentially they looked at actually how to extend logic to include uncertainty. And in fact, we actually developed, we jointly developed the applications of essentially predicate logic, or what I call bilattice logic, essentially on for a particular search problem. And we have applied this. In fact, my main thought process there was the Bayesian problem is actually the most general way to think about it, but the Bayesian problem requires full specification of the conditional probability table. On the other hand, logic doesn't require complete specification. You can give partial specifications. And what is the advantage of partial specifications? You can quickly guess something and say, oh, that may be true. It may be 90% of the time true, but sometimes it's very wrong. So essentially, there is a way to use this for addressing the speed. That's exactly what we showed. So here is a concrete example of how we did it. So here is another good example of computer vision techniques and how computer vision actually is hard. Take a look at this. These are different images. This is actually an overhead image of ports. This is actually, you can't see anything here, unfortunately. The projector is bad. Actually, this is supposed to be airfields from a SAR image. So it's an acoustic radar image. This actually is a visual image taken. But what is common between these four pictures? If you look at it, you'll say, maybe it's just an overhead picture. But if you look at it closely, you would see that actually there are some circles here, and then there are a circular arrangement, and then there is some sort of a roadway around it, and so on. And here you can see there are circles, very, very faint circles, and they are arranged in a circular pattern, and there is a roadway. And here, I can't see anything, but it looks, it is, believe me, it's the same. And here, again, it looks very similar. So what's going on here? There is invariance. The invariance is actually in texture. But what is really the underlying pattern that's common is the function of that site. It turns out that the function of the site is to actually shoot down any incoming missile. So it's a surface-to-air missile site. And that arrangement is there so that you can actually point the turret and then you can shoot wherever it comes. And there is a central area, which is the building where things are housed. And then you have to move things in and out. So therefore, you need a road network. So that's a functional description of a pattern. And you need, and if you take an expert who has actually looked at these things, they will immediately tell you that's a site of interest. they're able to get past actually the texture variation, and they can basically be invariant actually to many parameters and still understand these pictures. That's really the essence of what we, what the reasoning algorithm and the invariance that you bring in by using rules on top. So the way we did it, we actually developed a dictionary of low-level entities which deals with circles, line segments, scene texture, and so on. We essentially formulated a grammar which describes actually the scenario, and then we essentially did inference. So effectively, these elements are the primitive attributes of things that are extracted from the image, and then this is the description of this pattern. And this is the description that is an object-oriented based network for the pattern. So it says, okay, the SAM site essentially contains a bunch of launcher sites, it contains geometry, it has elliptical geometry, blah, blah, blah. It has a radar station site in the center, it has a road network, and it has launcher sites. So that's sort of the description of essentially this. You can actually put some probabilities and you can have variations of this distribution. And when you use this two-stage model that I talked about, hypothesis generation, fast indexing, followed by verification, you could do things like, oh, find me the top K SAM sites. Okay, and then it'll actually pull up the top K SAM sites. And you can show that it's actually doing better than other standard classifiers. Again, I don't want to, this is basically just for publication's sake. We all know that whenever you choose a representation and you choose a particular paradigm, there is a fundamental limit in the paradigm. And you need to understand what that limit is. And that's the key essence of system engineering. That is that you understand that anything that you do is an estimate. It has uncertainty. And any combinations of filters that you apply on that will give you uncertainty. Therefore, magic doesn't happen. Okay, so therefore, you need to understand really what essentially a set of operations, how they behave, in what context, so that you can decide how to flexibly use module after module in different contexts. We did the same thing with the airfields, and we showed that you can make a better system. Now, where are we going? I hope that I've shown you that actually thinking holistically is actually a good thing, and that actually it leads to better designs. And we actually have shown that in practice, I've actually had the opportunity to work with many people to show that you can actually do modular design, you can layer and encapsulate these designs, and you can use high-level design tools. That's one thing. And you can do formal modeling. You can actually have a library of modules which essentially address many problems. And then you can compose these mechanisms, and if you have a toolbox, you can make new systems faster. If you have seen the scenarios before, for which you have designed systems for. And we need to have, I think that fundamentally, there's a lot of science work to be done in modeling of the application context, in understanding performance, and in understanding compositional systems. And I also try to give you an insight that you need to have the user view of the system, that is the operator, and then you have to have the architect view, that's the modeler, and then you have to have the implementation view of the system, which actually tells you how to translate it. You need all of these views in order to build actually a holistic system design. And what essentially is the future research? I believe that model-based design thinking is reasonably mature. There are lots of open questions, but it's reasonably mature, and I have a sort of a understanding of how we can move forward. What we need essentially is to fuse this kind of model-based thinking with the machine learning world, data-driven learning, and autonomous learning that's basically going on in the Bernstein project, to really figure out how to minimize the user involvement in design. That's the next frontier that we're after. It'll take us another 10, 15 years, but I believe we can get there. And this requires cross-disciplinary research linking AI, psychology, neuroscience, vision, language, signal processing, applied math, statistics, machine learning. And you need all of these things. And visual understanding really is a core aspect of intelligence. In fact, it relates to general intelligence. And you can think about how this scales up to general intelligence platform, including text, signals, and combinations thereof.